From the Civic Media Radio Network, moving Wisconsin forward one joke at a time. This is As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. Hello, Wisconsin!
Now, filling in for the new mom, here's Jane Matinere.
Good morning and welcome, welcome to As Goes Wisconsin, coming to you live from our studio in beautiful downtown Waukesha. Got a very full show today. Lots of guests. Greg Bach with me in studio. Calvin is on the board. Todd Alba from the wonderful Todd Alba Show, airing across the network from noon to 2 p.m. And like I said, we have many guests joining us coming up at 10:30. Journal Sentinel reporter John Dietrich is going to be back with the next piece in their ongoing series about guns in Wisconsin. And some really interesting things that they discovered in a poll that was conducted. So we will share that with you. Joseph Pecky joining us next hour at 11:06 to talk about Project 2025 and what that could mean for the United States of America. And then a Germantown parent, Melissa Garvis, will be joining us to talk about what is going on with their school district. Busy show.
Yes,
lots
indeed.
Of stuff on the way.
Yes.
Good morning, Todd Alba. How are you? How was your weekend?
Jane, Greg, Kelvin, I am always happy to be with you. Start my work week back to school with the fantastic As It Goes Wisconsin and all your listeners. I was nice. I was up in beautiful Green Bay, Shawnee area. My dad and stepmom live in Shawnee, so we kind of had that side of the family holiday Christmas
get nice.
Together. So, even got a dusting of snow overnight on
Ooh.
Saturday. So, made it a little Christmassy. So, how about you guys?
It was great. Yeah. I had lunch. My sister and I had lunch on Saturday. I don't know if I really want to go into this. Okay. My husband and I have a side door to our house. There's a front door and a side door. When they took the side door out to replace it with a new door, the frame cracked, and then it turned out that the new door was the wrong size.
Ooh.
So it has taken, that was a month and a half ago. So our side door has been boarded up for a month and a half. So we have to go out the front door for everything and then go around to the garage. It's been lovely. And in addition, when we got back
from, Chapter two.
In addition, when we got back from vacation in September, the dryer wasn't working. My dryer is not working. So I cannot get anyone to fix it. I have tried to find service guys to fix my dryer, and it's a particular make. It's a Bosch. No one will fix them. So now I have to take my laundry over to my sister's to dry my laundry every weekend.
I'm sorry.
These are stories.
It's slightly amusing.
These are stories of the plains.
This is my life right now.
Then I travel.
Are you cooking? Are you cooking with lard, James?
Yes,
is that also what's going on?
And coal. And we have coal now in the house.
Then I have to make the 2-day journey to my sister's house to dry the clothing.
On a horse cart. Yes. So.
And of course, I must go out the
truly
front door.
Am sorry. I truly am sorry, because it's an inconvenience.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
It throws off your rhythm, your schedule, and it's just like, oh, man.
Well, and
seems right.
I would get a new dryer, except they can't get it out the side door because the side door is boarded up until we get the new door. It's
this
true.
Side door is stifling the economy.
You are not
buying things because you don't have a side door.
This is messing my life up.
Thanks, Joe
big
Biden.
Time. So anyway, that's my tale of woe for this morning. We're going to talk about what happened over the weekend, Todd, with the UW System Board of Regents. But I wanted to start out with something that jumped out at me on Twitter this morning, posted by Ben Wickler with the Wisconsin Democratic Party. This is from the Secretary of State, Sarah Godlewski, writing Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux. December 14th, 2020, a falsified certificate of votes for the presidential election was submitted. The document signed by 10 individuals, including Wisconsin Election Commissioner Robert Spindell Jr., claiming to be duly elected and qualified Wisconsin elector for Donald Trump. On December 6th, my office notified that those 10 Republicans, including Spindell, acknowledged their actions in the 2020 election with a certificate of votes were fraudulent, and that the Trump campaign intended to use it as an effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Wisconsin deserves election commissioners that have the utmost respect for the law and a strong moral compass. Based on his acknowledgement of his role in the scheme to overturn the election, I'm calling you to immediately remove Robert Spindell from the Election Commission. I don't think that's likely at all, Todd. Do you?
You'll probably get a side door fixed before that happens.
That's if the door comes on time.
That's a callback, folks.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, do I think that Secretary of State Godlewski is correct? Absolutely. Do I think it'll happen? Absolutely not. It's just, it's politics is where we are today. And it's unfortunate, but I do think that it's a good, it's prudent. I think it's a good thing for Secretary of State Godlewski to have on record to say that she asked for this, because you never know what might come down the line. And one thing that we kind of gleaned out of this story from the Washington Post last week when all this broke from Patrick Marley was that people like Andrew Hitt and, whoops, oh, there's... You want to talk to Dale Schultz? Dale Schultz is calling. Should we just put him on the air?
Say hi to Dale.
Sorry about that. One thing we learned from the Washington Post story is that former Republican Party Chairman Andrew Hitt and others are now apparently cooperating with state investigations. That leads me to believe that although it's not public, perhaps State Attorney General Josh Call is in fact conducting a criminal investigation, may bring charges. So I think this is a good piece to have on the record, because in the future, if Spindell gets charged with a criminal offense, you know, you can go back and say, look, we've been calling for this for weeks, months, whatever it is. And I think it gives, you know, the right side of the law another piece of ammunition. Do I think this one letter will change Lemmy Hugh's mind? No.
Well, and also because, I mean, LeMahieu appointed Spindell in 2021.
Yeah.
Again, to the commission after all the shenanigans had gone on in the first place.
Yeah. No, I mean, they were part of it. I mean, in terms of knowing. I mean, none of these people are innocent of knowledge, right? They knew what was going on. And I think that's another thing that came out of the Washington Post reporting. All these different text messages, even the people that conducted this stuff on January 6th, even people, these fake electors who signed this stuff, it was revealed either in text messages and deposition or in the January 6th bipartisan commission in Washington, D.C., that these people had a sense they were doing something wrong. I think the woman that delivered the actual ballots texted, I'm paraphrasing now, but something like, you know, I feel like a drug dealer. Well, you know what? You don't tell someone that you know and work with, I feel like a drug dealer over what I'm doing, if you don't feel that it's the wrong thing to do. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just have to wonder, for these 10 fake electors, did they just go to bed at night and sleep soundly thinking this was never going to, you know, this was never going to come to the light of day? They were never going to get found out. It's all going to be, everything's going to be just fine.
I don't think they care. I think at the end of the day, when they go to bed at night, they think ultimately what they did was for the better of the country. And because those people didn't listen, that's not my problem. I tried to help. I tried to be the one who saved this democracy. That's probably what they're going to bed thinking.
Yeah, you're probably right. If you're just joining us, Todd Alba is our guest for this first hour, as he is every Monday while Kristen is on maternity leave. You can hear his show, The Todd Alba Show, from noon to 2 across the Civic Media Radio Network. Greg Bach with me in studio, Calvin on the board, and we're going to switch things over, Todd, to the UW Board of Regents on Friday, voting 9-8 against this deal between the assembly, essentially, or Robin Voss, and the university system. Or did that take you by surprise?
How much time do you have?
we got some time.
Got 2 minutes. Yes, I guess nothing surprises me anymore, but it was unexpected. And the reason it was unexpected is because rarely do the Board of Regents not take unanimous vote, because what a lot of people don't know is, and this has been happening for years, that the staff of the president in the president's office for UW system, they call around to make sure they don't violate any open records laws, and they basically ask all the Board of Regents, how are you going to vote? And so by the time you get there, everything is cut and dried, and everybody
no
knows
surprises.
What's going to happen. No surprises. And so you would have thought in something so high profile that this would have been cut and dried. And I think the biggest thing, I don't know why I was unexpected or even a surprise, is that the ineptitude of President Jay Rothman of the UW system and his staff, because they clearly, I mean, the great Capital Times reporter, I forget her name, asked this question on Friday and said, were there any people of color at the table? And he took about 30 seconds, Rothman did, to say no. And he danced around it. And remember, you know, anytime a politician says anything other than yes, it's no. And anything other than no is a yes. And he clearly said no. And so when you don't have anybody of color, of diversity, at the table discussing diversity, equity, and inclusion, mm-hmm. and you don't include people of diversity at the table, what do you expect? And so I think that there were coalition groups that were surprised by this. They lobbied people on the board of regions. The regions then, I don't know if they were even ever on, quote unquote, on board. We're going to vote yes. If this was a last minute change, that's what some people say. There was a great video of Channel 3000, President Rothman slamming his hand on the table when the vote occurred, and Regent Kathy Walsh putting her face in her hands. This is what we used to call in political parlance a TFD, I'll be careful, a total freaking disaster. And I'll simply add this. The one thing I'm and I've got all kinds of notes, I'll let somebody else talk. I think we have to be very careful here that Democrats are not hold harmless here, in my opinion, and liberals, because I've been talking about this system, UW system, for over a year. They attacked rural education, and Democrats and progressives, other than Kelda Royce, largely said nothing. Tony Evers said nothing. They closed the Richland campus. They closed the Washington campus. They closed the Fond du Lac campus. Over 2.5 weeks ago, Rothman came out and said he wanted to take things away from the poor folks in Wisconsin. And largely, Democrats and progressives have stayed silent. The education governor has said virtually nothing. And it took this issue for people to finally step up and say something. And I'm a little salty about that. I agree with what they're saying about diversity, equity, inclusion, that it's important. But why did it take this issue, a very personal issue for some people, to step up and finally start defending higher education in Wisconsin?
I like salty Todd.
Me too.
I think we should we should have more,
you know,
more doses of salty Todd.
Salty Todd and Calviente. Calviente.
All right, when we come back, what was in this deal that I particularly think was a good thing for the Popcorn King? You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media's Radio Network. Like I knew. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. Jane Matinier in Fort Kristen Bry. Greg Bach with me in studio. Todd Alba joining us on the stream. Calvin is on the board. You can always join us at 844-967-2789. 844-96.
Party.
Talking about the kind of surprise over the weekend involving the University Board of Regents rejecting a deal offered by Assembly Speaker, essentially Robin Voss, to finally pay these, 35,000 people whose raises were approved and they've been sitting on this money and refusing to pay out this money because of diversity, inclusion, equity, and inclusion mm-hmm. programs.
Yep.
So the Regents, by a vote of 9-8, rejected that on Saturday. One thing, Todd, that really jumped out at me with this original deal, because the news broke about that after our show was over on Friday, and I know you spent quite a time talking about it in the first part of your show on Friday, but the deal includes some sweet things for Robin Voss, it seems to me, as far as a whole big pile of money going to Whitewater.
It's very interesting.
Isn't
in
it?
Fact, it's $78.5
million.
$78 million for a renovation of two buildings on the Whitewater campus. I did look them up. They are not, to best I can see, they are not dormitories or student housing. They are basically old class or administrative buildings, that sort of thing. And I said on Friday, look, I haven't been to those buildings at Whitewater. I don't know. Maybe they legit need fixing. And if they do, I got no problem with it. What I have a problem with is, again, Robin Voss, the Republicans, looked people in Richland County, Washington County, and Fond du Lac in the eye and said, we can't come up with $2 to $3 million to save your two-year campus. Quote, there is no money.
Yep.
That from Howard Markline, the joint chairman of the Joint Finance Committee. However, they found $78.5 million for these two buildings in Whitewater, and they didn't give other universities, apparently, the opportunity to say, well, maybe we have needs of $40 million
sure.
or $20 million. But are these buildings in Whitewater really the most needy of this time? And also, Jane, I think you have a little clue here for folks, maybe why Robin Voss wanted those buildings in Whitewater.
Well, because Robin Voss owns 23 properties in Whitewater that he rents out to college kids.
Mm-hmm. What?
Yes,
I'm shocked.
I know.
Dun, dun, dun.
I was taken aback myself. As a matter of fact, there's an article from 2020 in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talking about Robin Voss as a landlord in Whitewater. And it's estimated, and this is from 2020 again, his company owns 23 properties worth almost $4 million in Whitewater. That's a nice chunk of change.
That's a nice chunk.
It's nice if you can find it.
Yeah, it's nice if you can find it. But that raises my eyebrows.
Yeah.
Out of all of the universities, that $78 million has to go to Whitewater because we want to make sure that students are still attending school in Whitewater so I can rent to them.
And I'm sure he is a fastidious, gracious, and fantastic landlord. Just up to code, up to speed. Nothing gets by old Rob's face. He's getting those repairs done. And he's keeping people living in comfort. Right, Jane? That's what I thought. Thanks for listening, everybody. No,
it's interesting. In this article, again, this is from 2020 in the Journal Sentinel Online, they talked to previous renters, and not everybody complained.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this, hey, it's college housing. We're a bunch of kids. I don't expect it to be the Taj Mahal. But there was one young woman and her five roommates who said there were mold problems, there were electrical problems, and after a certain amount of time, they couldn't... It never got fixed.
Yeah.
And so they
and that was just his marriage.
The rise of Salty Todd.
But so Voss's company sued them when they moved out, said they broke their lease. She countersued. As that countersuit was working its way through the system, Mr. Voss and other fellow Republicans who are landlords in the Wisconsin legislature were ushering through new rules for landlords to cap the amount that they would have to pay in damages.
What? Huh. Todd, this is... So...
Huh.
I don't... Fake yeah, news.
I know, shocking. No, I sadly was working in the building when some of these quote-unquote landlord-tenant revisions happened, and they were about 95% in favor of landlords
yeah.
at the time.
No kidding.
And it was... Yeah, I know, shocking, I know. And so, yeah, look, I've never been to these properties. I don't know. I don't want to put something out there that's, you know, clearly not accurate or true. But to me, it certainly does not pass the smell test. And it just doesn't look good. And I think one of the most interesting parts of President Jay Rothman's press conference on Friday is when, and again, it shows that he's an attorney, not a politician or somebody who worked in higher ed administration. He said, quote, that's something that Speaker Voss specifically asked for. I mean, he kind of let the cat out of the bag. I mean,
whoops.
You just don't say that. I mean, you don't let that out, you know, that this is something that Voss specifically asked for in negotiations. So, I mean, this is just another nail in Jay Rothman's coffin, political coffin, because you just don't say stuff like that.
I mean, does Jay Rothman even want the job then? You got to ask yourself, he's not put himself in a position that makes it seem like he really wants the job anymore.
It will be interesting to see how this all shakes out. And I also think that this specific ask by Robin Voss, to me, is an indication that he's planning on leaving office and he needs to have a little nest egg set up mm-hmm. to make sure he's taken care of after he's out of office.
I mean, I've said, you know, there are certainly, I'll clarify, or not clarify, but make sure, there are rumors. I don't know this for a fact, but there is a line of thinking right now in the Republican circles that Voss may not finish out his current term, and is seriously, if he does, would not run for re-election in 2024.
Why would
he not finish out his term?
Because if he's got landlord, if he's making millions of dollars of housing in Whitewater, and he's got his popcorn business, who needs 55 or 60,000, whatever it is, for all this?
Do you know why? To spend more time with his family.
That's always the reason, isn't it? No, to spend more time with my family.
Yeah,
family?
I think he wants to get out before there are any changes to the maps. And he might actually have a chance of losing and actually have to respond to the needs of his constituents instead of his donors.
I think that, and I do think he will, if he does, I mean, that makes sense too. If he steps down, he doesn't have the shame of being primaried out.
Right.
I mean, that's just...
It would be embarrassing. All right, stay with us. The news is coming up next. When we come back, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Dietrich is going to be joining us for part two in a series the paper has done on gun ownership in Wisconsin. Fascinating article. Stay with us. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin across the Civic Media Radio Network. And welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. Jane Matinere in for Kristen Bry. Kristen will be back with us on Wednesday at this time from 10:30 to 11. So make sure you join us then. Very happy to have you along. Greg Bach with me in studio. Todd Alba on the stream. Calvin on the board. And joining us for the second time to talk about the series that is running in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Journal Sentinel investigative reporter John Dietrich is here to talk about your newest piece on guns in Wisconsin. Good morning, John. Thanks so much for taking time. I know you have a big trip coming up tomorrow.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Jane. Really appreciate being back here. But yeah, I'm out off to Spain tomorrow. Our son is graduating from college, and he's done his schooling over in Madrid. So we're super excited.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty awesome. So this latest piece in the series about guns, poll of gun owners in Wisconsin shows more are getting guns for self-defense, and 3 in 5 of them keep them locked. Now, this was a poll that was done in conjunction with Marquette, correct, John?
Mm-hmm, that's right. So I did this project through the O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism, and that allows us, you know, for like a whole year to work for Marquette, work with students, and also to make connections on campus. One of those connections with Charles Franklin, who is most well-known pollster, I would guess, really, in the state of Wisconsin through the law school. And he helped me formulate this poll. Charles always asks some gun questions. You guys would be familiar on his poll that he does with registered voters as he's sort of getting, you know, people's what they might, which way they will vote and so forth. But what this, the idea here was just to get a poll that was just to gun owners. And so that's all we went for. That's our whole, and that's a group, I should say that's a subject that is difficult to pull on. Gun ownership and people's income is two things that Charles said is like that's a big tap out line for him in his polling.
Really?
So to get just gun owners or people who own guns to talk. And, you know, we don't really know exactly why that is, but that's just one of those facts in polling. So we try to lean into that and try to come up with some wording. Maybe the wording is part of what it is. So we were really thoughtful about trying to come up with wording, the way we structured it. And it's so it's that, you know, Charles, and talking to others, this is the largest, most in-depth poll of gun owners in Wisconsin to date.
Yeah, 345, right?
Yep, right there. Yep, right there.
So what, and the reason why I'm so happy that you're doing this, John, is because I am not from a gun owning family. We were not a hunting family. We didn't, you know, target practice. It just wasn't part of my childhood. And even to this day, I don't know that many. I have some in my family who are hunters, but it helps me understand people better because I don't always understand where gun owners are coming from. And what I think is so valuable about your series is that it gives some insight into that. So was there anything that you found in this poll that really jumped out at you as a surprise?
Well, I mean, I think I was just actually being asked that because just before your podcast, I was just on a different podcast from somebody who writes for an audience specifically of gun owners. So he's a Second Amendment, strong Second Amendment supporter and so forth. And it's interesting, that community is interested to talk to us as well, had a similar question. I think one of the things that was, I have to just gauge this in that some of the expectation of what I thought I knew is populated by social media. Okay.
Interesting.
And more I'm like, is that actually true? Or am I getting, you know, like dispatches from the edges and from flattened people that are not really allowed to like see sort of the whole, you know, the whole, what might feel like inconsistencies or contradictions, but they're just people, right? So and that's what we're trying to do in this project is like behind the gun is seeing people's humanity first. And they happen to all own this object, but they have different, you know, different views and practices. A couple of things. So I say that with some of my expectations or what I thought I knew was maybe colored by, you know, by social media and things, drips and drabs like that. And I do know gun owners. I don't own a gun right now. I did grow up in a household, well, sort of part-time in a household where there was one. But anyway, had experiences with it. And so I guess what was surprising a little bit to me and might be surprising to people is that our largest category of people who own guns, well, it's handguns are the most popular firearm. I sort of knew that. AR-15s are the least. So hunting rifles, shotguns, AR-15s. And Wisconsin has, according to another poll, the lowest percentage of AR-15 ownership in the country.
Really?
Yes. So right about 17 to 19% of gun owners in our poll, and that matches a national poll that was done by Georgetown. What we don't know is, what's the next question? Why? The handguns make sense because handguns are, like, they're just multiple use. They also fall into the self-defense category. They also populate the shooting sport category. They're not so much hunting. That would be the traditional hunting rifle or the shotgun. The reason why AR-15 ownership may be less is because of our hunting culture. And there certainly are people who hunt with AR-15s, and you talk about the mechanisms and how a traditional hunting rifle and AR-15 mechanically, there's a lot of similarities there. But there's also a cultural thing that I'm gathering about using an AR-15 or something like that, which especially the multiple rounds to hunt. That can lead to, how do you put this, a culture of derision in certain deer camps.
So it's gun
Wisconsin.
So it's gun shaming, essentially. it's gun shaming.
Among gun owners. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is, of all my friends who have guns who live here, their attitude towards the AR-15 is like, I don't need that. No one needs that. That's a stupid weapon. It's almost like it honestly doesn't surprise me. Because I know a lot of people own guns. It doesn't surprise me that the percentage is so low because it's just seen as like, I have a handgun for self-defense. I have a rifle for hunting. that gun is unnecessary to me or anyone. There's no reason to have it. Just that made sense when I heard the number.
Todd, I saw you have a look of recognition too when we were talking about this. I can't imagine that most self-respecting hunters would endorse the use of that weapon in that instance, because isn't it overkill?
Yeah, John, thanks so much for coming on the program, by the way. I grew up in Southwest Wisconsin, a town of 5,000 people. My grandparents were dairy farmers, so I was in the woods from almost the time I could walk, went to hunter safety at 11, and started deer hunting at 12, and did so well into my early 40s when CWD became prominent. That's why I kind of quit hunting deer, was because of that. I still occasionally go turkey and bird hunting, but... I don't know. I mean, if you would have brought an AR-15 into our family deer camp when my granddad was alive, he would have told you to go home and some choice words. And then it's just unseemly. It's like, if you're that bad of a shot, I don't want you around me, basically.
Yeah. Seriously.
But John, one of the things I great reporting, by the way, in this story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. One of the things that I found interesting, I did not know, was your report that 71 of 100 gun deaths in Wisconsin are suicide, and that rural areas are affected the most. I found that both fascinating and tragic as someone who grew up in a rural area in Wisconsin. Does that tie into what I know that Jane and Greg have talked to Pam Yonke from Midwest Farm Report on Civic Media about this mental health crisis we see in rural Wisconsin ag communities? Does that tie in with these findings?
Yeah, it does. So one of the questions that we asked, and thank you for that. One of the questions that we asked was if you had, if you knew somebody who had gone through a crisis, a suicidal thoughts type crisis, who was a fellow gun owner. We asked the question in a way that we felt was more invitational, because if you ask the question directly, it can be off-putting, might be not even the right word. But what we found is more than 25% of the groups, the gun owners that we talked to, said that was something that they had done, that they were aware of. And also that same number had held firearms for a friend, a loved one, and so forth in those time. What happens is, and this isn't red flag or any of that sort of stuff, no government involvement. This is a practice among gun owners that's been going on sort of under the detection of researchers for a long time. Researchers who coincidentally are not gun owners, so it sort of makes sense they wouldn't know about it. But when they started to do some of this work among gun owners, they started to learn about this. So depending on how you think, that's not a huge number, but it is a big number because you're talking about suicide. So that's a huge outcome that these thoughts have come. And what I appreciate is that what we're trying to do is not throughout this series is have like a gotcha thing. I get what you're saying about the AR-15, because it is for some people kind of like, but I interviewed people who do use the AR-15 for hunting. But it's not like an extended magazine and they're like, it's not that. It's a single shot and the upper receiver is the same as the traditional hunting rifle. There are differences. But what we're trying to do in each one of these categories is be invitational and not like finger wag
right.
so much.
Right.
And I'm not, as I do that, I'm not finger wagging my colleagues, right? To be clear on that, I'm not trying to shame other journalists, because like I've been doing this for 20 years at the Journal Sentinel. I've written stories that I think people would look back and I even look back and like, oh, that's kind of like wagging a finger at people. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Jane, one quick question. Is okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
One quick question. My sister is a better shot. She won a gold medal, international gold medal in shooting back when in the Daisy BB gun days. She's a 10 times better shot. Once we went to shoot in our 30-06s to go deer hunting, and this older guy, he looks at, oh, this little girl's going to, try to, and my sister shoots. He looks at his scope and he goes, blankety blank blank, she got a bullseye. I mean, he couldn't believe this, young female is, a great shot. And she is. But the point is, in the story you write, that women in your survey, in your reporting, that women are is it overkill, or is it too much to say they're more thoughtful gun owners? They use locks more, they take more care, and also that more women are owning guns in Wisconsin. I found that interesting, but based on my sister's experience, not surprising.
That is true. And what we're seeing, because we also gauged ownership since the pandemic, March of 2020. So we see those categories, coming up anecdotally from in training sessions, in classes. They're telling me more women are showing up. And there's some markers. You know, again, we would say maybe not use the term like more responsible, because we're trying to get more descriptive than using catchphrases. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying like that. That's what we tried to do. But the markers around like storage, separation of lethal means, you know, these sorts of things, we're seeing some differences, among women. We also overrepresented in our survey, probably for women. You know, we're right about at 50% female ownership of firearms. In Wisconsin's probably more around 40%, but it does seem to be going up. We're seeing other categories we featured William Olivier in our series, who's African-American guy, Christine Joyce Brown, who's LGBTQ+, Emily Schmucke, who's a woman from Waukesha, and Christine is a transgender woman. And so there are different categories, new voices. And that's where I just am sort of like, too, there isn't like one community of gun owners. There is a lot of different people that own this object, mm-hmm. who have different thoughts and practices, voting patterns, beliefs and reasons that, you know, that they own firearms.
We will be back. Stay with us. John Dietrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about the latest in a series on guns in Wisconsin. Some really, really interesting details you have found out in the course of reporting this. Stay with us. You're listening to As Goes Wisconsin across the Civic Media Radio Network.
They want your business.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
Good morning and welcome to As Goes Wisconsin. Jane Matt Mayer in for Kristen Bry. Calvin is on the board, Todd Alba on the stream, Greg Bach with me in studio, and we are joined also by Journal Sentinel investigative reporter John Dietrich, out with a new story in their series on gun ownership in Wisconsin. And John, one of the things that Todd had alluded to was the growing number of women who are buying firearms and also tend to handle them a little bit more safely with gun locks and safes and things like that.
Yeah, so when we looked at the different categories of how people keep guns at home, that's a big one that's talked about a lot, especially depending on who's in the house. And we've had these very incredibly tragic incidents. It's not super common. It's 1% of gun deaths, and it also perhaps falls in a category of intervention in a different way. So securing firearms is a big category. I found that to be the case definitely among gun owners that I talked to, that this is a thoughtful thing, that how they keep and why they keep. And in the case of Emily Schmucke, who I talked to, so she has two young children. She's had some issues where she lives that she's concerned about home protection. She keeps... she has two gun safes, and she keeps one near her bed bolted to the nightstand. And then she has another set because she has two firearms and another safe locked up. I think it was interesting to me that the majority of gun owners overall are keeping guns locked in safes. Okay, so that was a starting point. And so that impression may be different than what people think. I should also say that we're right around 350 gun owners here. there's more than a million gun owners in Wisconsin by estimates.
Right.
So we have to be careful not to say 350 represent for a million people. We're outside what we would call a statistical significance, you know, indicator. And that's just really important to, but it's not nothing to talk to 350 gun owners who answered everyone answered all of our questions.
No, it's
so
a
just
snapshot.
Want to make sure that people are safe.
Yeah, exactly. It's a snapshot.
Exactly. So, yeah.
The other thing I found so interesting was how many people who responded to this poll said they had used their gun defensively. So it was about 13%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that was interesting because it is what we tried to do. This is a highly debated measurement. It's called DGU, which is defensive gun use. Sort of on one side, you have people who are maybe more in favor of restrictions or more restrictions, say that's a really rare scenario that a defensive gun use happens. And then on the other side, those who might be in favor of fewer restrictions would say, oh, it's really common. And then there's some studies around this that are really hotly debated. I guess what we tried to do is define, first of all, what a defensive gun use is. Like, it's not just, discharging or firing a gun. Like, that is a defensive gun use if that's what the scenario is. But there's also things like announcing you have a gun, drawing a firearm, pointing it, things like that. So we tried to break it down in that way. And what we found was that it is a not a majority of gun owners report this. And it gets less and less, as you might imagine, of those. So of 357 gun owners said that they had discharged a gun, you know, defensively. And as you mentioned, the percentage is more of defensive gun use. The gun owners that I talked to, some were really surprised by that number and felt like it was higher even than what they thought.
Oh, really?
It would be. Yeah, Jeff Ferris was like, he's like, he's taught classes. He knows. He said, I have dozens and dozens of friends who are gun owners. They don't. None of them have ever used their gun defensively. Jeff also told me something that was really surprising, is Jeff was one of the most staunch supporters of concealed carry. He was one of the first 100 people in the state to receive concealed carry. And he rarely, like very rarely, has ever carried. And this was an interesting phenomenon that I think non-gun owners might assume, that 460,000 permit holders for CCW in Wisconsin are all carrying. It's not true. It's actually, according to Jeff, in his circle, very rare. He did a little like just talking to people at the gun shop that he works, and he's like, I talked to 100 people who have CCW permits, and like almost none of them carry.
How interesting.
And they want the permit for various reasons, but also when they take the class, if they've had a good thorough class, you know, which isn't, they're not all as good, you know, the state bar is pretty low. So if it's a good class like Jeff gives, you know, like what the details are around it. It's complicated. It's not a simple thing. And there's legal implications and there's legal calculations. There's a lot to go. And then there's just like physical carrying a firearm can be uncomfortable, let's put it that way. So that was surprising to me that there is a, you know, there's a distance maybe between the permit holders and the actual carry rate.
That's fascinating. I would never have expected that. We only have just a couple of minutes left. When you talk to these firearms teachers, are they seeing more people taking classes? I guess that is what I would like to see.
Yeah.
That everybody, if you're going to own a weapon, just make sure you know what you're doing with this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are seeing some upticks and some different kinds of people taking classes. And to be clear, talking among gun owners, hugely supportive of the training piece. You know, where it comes down to is the government the place to implement that? And that's, you know, and that's, there's a tension in there, but yet there's a commonality that's really like, let's talk about the agreed upon need for training. Can we talk about that and the means to get there? There may be some different routes through that. But yes, it is a huge focus in the people that I talk to about the right comes with that responsibility to train and retrain and be an asset, you know, instead of a liability.
Absolutely. John Diedrich is an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I highly encourage you to read the latest in the Journal Sentinel. He has about the use of guns, the poll of Wisconsin gun owners in Wisconsin. Really appreciate you taking the time, John. Thank you so very much. Have a wonderful trip. Enjoy Spain.
Thank you all. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, John. Take care. When we come back, Todd Alba, you are moving on because you have a show to prep for. So thank you so very much, Todd Alba. We will talk to you next Monday. Joseph Becky will be here when we come back at 11:06. We're going to talk about Project 2025. This is As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network. Check it off the floor. Get on the floor.